down.
What's going on? What are you still going on? Tanya Dunhaskigo, then on Zewa Dahusa Dutch, Ungahuan, and Hadiwa Nodus, and the Aboriginal Voices, Oscar Dewa Nyawar Oscar, Ne Jota FM, CFRC.
Hey, I'm Andy from the Astros, and you're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! This is CFRC 101.9 FM, www.cfrc.ca, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario.
CFRC 101.9 FM has new social media. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at CFRC Music and keep up with the latest announcements about our programming and projects. Follow us today at CFRC Music.
KPP Concerts and CFRC 101.9 FM present a stacked lineup of shows this January and February at the Broom Factory, featuring a mix of big-name acts and some local favorites. On January 18th, don't miss Canadian alt-rock duo Mountain Head. January 24th features local indie rock outfit Cassador. On January 26th, Bedouin Soundclash takes the stage. February 7th sees Busty and the Bass come to town. And on February 19th, it's a special Wednesday night rock show with headliners Dear Rouge. For additional information and to buy tickets, visit kppconcerts.com.
When I say beat, you say banter.
Morning, students. Question. If Queen's doesn't offer its workers a fair contract by February 3rd, who will be affected? Anyone? Answer. Those who live in residence, use university facilities, eat in campus cafeterias, and attend classes and labs.
So basically everyone.
Correct. It's time for Queen's to take responsibility and ensure the well-being of their workers and students.
Message brought to you by QP Locals 229, 254, and 1302.
Hey, students. Have you stumbled in your course and want a fresh start? Well, At the Best University has your back. AU offers more than 850 courses that align to your program, so you can retake your course online, turn that grade around, improve your GPA, explore new subjects, and study from anywhere. Visit atthebestu.ca to browse our online courses and transform your education today.
This is Glenn Close on CFRC 101.9 FM on Queen's University campus in Kingston.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome, everyone. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. On today's show, we will focus on the occupied West Bank, more specifically on the refugee camp of Jenin in West Bank. This month, Jenin has been the target, first of the Palestinian Authority forces, which imposed a siege on the camp. Then last week, the Israeli occupation military joined in the attack on the same camp. We will see why Jenin is often the target of the Israeli occupation military and why the Palestinian Authority keeps helping the occupation against its own people. After that, we will focus on Gaza and see what are the ambitions of both Netanyahu and Trump's governments in Gaza. We will see how Egypt and Jordan's government have been so far the reason these ambitions are not completely coming to fruition yet. Stay tuned.
On the 21st of January 2025, the Palestinian Authority hastily withdrew their security forces, which had been laying siege to Jenin refugee camp for over a month. Shortly after, the Israeli army entered and closed off all the entrances and exits to the camp, and since then they have been shooting anyone who tries to leave. People on the ground claim that PA's security forces removed many of the weapons from the camp during the siege, severely weakening the resistance and effectively clearing the way for the Israelis. This particular episode was recorded prior to the ceasefire in Gaza and the Israeli invasion of Jenin, In it, Yumna Patel, editor-in-chief of One Device, interviews me about the Palestinian Authority's siege of the camp and its aspirations for rule over Gaza, providing crucial context for what's currently unfolding.
Dr. Hawari, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Yara, I wanted to start by asking you to just first help us contextualize the events in Jenin for our listeners. What has led us to this point?
So Jenin and really the wider northern West Bank, including areas such as Dulkarm and around Nablus, have long been a thorn in the side of the PA, the Palestinian Authority, because of the presence of armed resistance groups, groups that are not only resisting the Israeli regime's occupation of their lands, but also, crucially, are in opposition to the PA. And there's various reasons why they're in opposition, ideological reasons, refusal of the increasing authoritarianism of the PA, but also, crucially, the security coordination mechanism between the PA and the Israeli regime. And this is where they coordinate on all matters pertaining to security. And I think coordination doesn't even describe the reality very well. It's a form of subordination. The Israeli regime tells the PA what to do security-wise, and for a large part, it complies. And that's because the PA's existence is predicated on that fact that this coordination continues. And so the PA has done its job of subduing Palestinian armed resistance against the Israeli regime in really large parts of the areas of the West Bank that it governs. But there are areas, and particularly in refugee camps, where they haven't been able to do that. And that includes Jenin. And so what we're seeing now is, as a result of increased pressure from the Israeli regime on the Palestinian Authority to gain control over these areas and to once and for all subdue the armed resistance groups there.
And Yara, you said that the existence of the PA is predicated on this security coordination. Could you just tell us a little bit more about what you mean by that?
So after the Oslo Accords, PA was established as the governing body of certain areas of the West Bank, the Bantustans, as it were. And this was premised on the idea that it would maintain full security cooperation or coordination with the Israelis. So it would be in complete communication with the Israelis on all matters pertaining to security. Now, security here is a sort of a code word for any kind of armed resistance groups, any kind of armed operations against the Israeli regime. And it includes also all kinds of training, all kinds of sharing of information. And the PA, in turn, has used it to crack down on political opposition. And the Israeli regime has used it to crack down on groups that it fears.
I want to go back to Jenin right now. The fact that this PA operation is happening in Jenin specifically, I mean, you mentioned that there is armed resistance. There are groups all over the northern West Bank. But the fact that it's happening in Jenin also carries a deep significance, right? I mean, the PA, if it was carrying out this massive of an operation anywhere in the West Bank, it would be news. But it's clear that there is this message that the PA is trying to send here by targeting Jenin. What is that message to Palestinians in the West Bank?
So for a long time, Jenin has occupied this very significant place in the hearts and minds of Palestinians. It's known for its resistance fighters, for its steadfastness. It has seen some of the most brutal attacks by the Israeli regime, including the infamous Battle of Jenin in 2002 during the Second Intifada, when the camp was invaded by Israeli soldiers and large parts were razed to the ground. I think 35% of the camp was destroyed and there were massacres. But there was also a resistance struggle that for many put up a heroic fight against these invaders. And so there is this collective narrative of Jenin being this historic site of resistance, but also a present site of resistance, you know, especially as so many other urban hubs in the West Bank have been subdued. And so in a way, what the PA is doing now is not surprising. It's very symbolic that it's going after this particular area. And it's a very clear message that the PA will work hand in glove with the Israelis to quell armed and popular resistance. And it's also very much connected to what's happening in Gaza with the genocide. You know, the Israeli regime is really battling on all fronts to and once and for all end the Palestinian armed resistance, which, you know, most analysts will agree is an impossible feat. But they've recruited the PA to assist in that endeavor. And I think it's even more of a blow to Palestinian morale, you know, at a time of genocide when your so-called leadership has done very little to stop it. Rather, it's collaborating with the Israelis to put down resistance elsewhere. So that on the one level, there's a very, you know, practical goal in mind, and that's to eradicate armed resistance. But there's also a goal of damaging the Palestinian morale at a time when it's at a low.
Yeah, and this connection to Gaza and the connection to Israel's attacks on Palestinian resistance and Palestinian life is critical. And we're going to talk about that later, because ultimately, I mean, that is really the context to understand what's happening now. But I want to go a little bit more in depth into the current operation that the PA is conducting in Jenin, just to paint a picture for listeners, for people who maybe have been following the news but aren't totally clear on, you know, what are the power dynamics that are at play right now. So the PA has said that it's conducting this quote-unquote operation in order to establish law and order. I think to the average person, that sort of language, you know, evokes comparisons to gangs or other quote unquote lawless groups that are operating maybe in contravention or outside of law enforcement. But could you explain why in this specific context, in the context of Palestine and of Jenin, the dynamics here are different than what would be typically thought of in, you know, popular culture as a lawless group?
The Palestinian Authority, the PA, as you mentioned, is using this language of law and order in an attempt to win over popular opinion and to reinforce the notion that it is this governing authority in the West Bank. And I think it has worked on some small sectors of, you know, the population, but by and large, people know that this is propaganda. Firstly, because the people know who these groups are, you know, they're not necessarily new groups that are being targeted by the PA. And secondly, because people understand the reality that the only governing authority in the West Bank is the Israeli occupation. So the PA is using this kind of language as a smokescreen to obscure the reality, to also to fearmonger. And I think this happens not just in Palestine, but I think in many contexts, the language of gangs and of, you know, people operating outside the law has always been deeply politicized, one that's often used against marginalized and impoverished communities. And it's not by coincidence that the PA is routinely targeting refugee camps. You know, when we talk about Jenin in this instance, we are talking about, you know, largely Jenin refugee camp, where those populations have been marginalized and excluded from the PA, from the national project for so long. And so this language is weaponized against people in particular from refugee camps, so that the PA can enforce control, can enforce political and practical control over these communities.
And I think it's really interesting to talk and important to speak about the community that these resistance groups are operating from, right? I mean, Mondo Weiss has done extensive reporting from inside the Jenin refugee camp and the areas around it. Of course, there people don't share one blanket opinion. You know, there's an array of nuanced perceptions and opinions when it comes to these dynamics. But overwhelmingly in our reporting, when our reporters or even myself, when we've gone and interviewed residents of the camp, residents who have experienced immense destruction and tragedy at the hands of Israeli authorities who are coming in to arrest people from the camp, and also recently, you know, to target these this resurgence of armed resistance. But despite this, the perception largely, I would say, is one where people understand and are sympathetic to and even supportive of these young men. Because at the end of the day, I mean, the young men that are fighting in these resistance groups, at least in Jenin, they're not these, you know, outside actors that are coming in, which is another kind of allegation that the PA has thrown at them, that they've got, you know, an outside agenda and are trying to disrupt order in Palestine. But the reality is these are mostly young men who were born and raised, grew up in the Jenin refugee camp, grew up under Israeli occupation and grew up witnessing the extreme violence that Israel exacted on their communities. And so, I mean, there's, and not just in Jenin, but we've seen over the years, polling has even showed immense public support for these resistance groups, at times even more so than the Palestinian Authority itself. So when it comes to this question of safety, right, and the PA accusing the Jenin Brigade in this case of endangering civilians, saying that the PA is trying to bring back safety and stability for the ordinary people of Jenin and the people of the Jenin refugee camp. How do you respond to that? I'm curious how you respond to that. And also, we don't, of course, want to speak on behalf of people in Jenin, but do you believe that the average person in Jenin would consider themselves, let's say, safe under PA rule, which is what the PA is implying here, that we're getting rid of these groups so that you can be safe under our control and our authority?
I mean, I think one thing can be sure is that people in Jenin refugee camp do not feel safe under a PA siege, which is what they're currently facing. And this question or this line of safety of that, you know, that the resistance groups are endangering civilians. We've heard this line before. We've heard it from the Israelis, that it's the Palestinians themselves that are endangering them, not the ones holding the guns, shooting at civilians. And it's really a form of deflecting the blame. I mean, this idea that the ones who are setting up the checkpoints in the camp, who are stationing snipers on rooftops, who are shooting at civilians, you know, including a young journalist who was standing on the doorstep of her own home, who are beating up ambulance crews, that they're the ones that are bringing safety and stability for ordinary people is ludicrous. And I think people in the camp see that very much with their own eyes. I think also people outside of the camp know that to be true as well. And it does absolutely nothing to instill confidence in the PA. I don't think people across the West Bank look to the PA for safety. We're talking about decades of Israeli occupation, of Israeli raids, of the demolition of homes, of mass incarceration across the board. You know, in the last year and a half, we've seen over 14,000 Palestinians from the West Bank incarcerated in Israeli prisons. And the PA has been nowhere to be seen. They have not provided safety or protection for the people that they claim to serve. So that line and that narrative is particularly egregious, I think, at a time of genocide, at a time of ongoing colonial occupation. So I think it's something that they have learned from the Israelis quite clearly. And I think it's not something that will be widely believed by the population in the West Bank.
If you're enjoying this podcast, please visit our website, al-shabaka.org, where you will find more Palestinian policy analysis and where you can join our mailing list and donate to support our work.
Yeah, I mean, you touched on two really critical points here. One being public opinion and public perception of the PA, which, as you said, this operation in Jenin is certainly not going to help that. You also, you know, when you were speaking about the different tactics that the PA has employed during its operation in Jenin, one can't help but draw the very obvious parallel and similarity, which is, you know, something that you've written about and something that you've been vocal about. So before I kind of ask you some more questions as to why we're seeing these parallels, can you just paint a picture for people? What are the tactics that the PA has been employing throughout its operation in Jenin that are very strikingly similar to the Israeli tactics that are employed when attacking Jenin.
As I mentioned before, we've seen the PA set up checkpoints across the camp, limiting the movement of residents. We've seen the PA as well place snipers on the top of rooftops. And if it weren't for their uniforms, one might mistake these snipers for Israeli soldiers. We've also seen a lot of videos on social media of beatings, of interrogations. There was a video during the rounds of two men, Palestinian men, being forced to stand on one leg and recite the president, Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas, is God, over and over. And there's another video of the security forces, the PA security forces, beating a young man senseless because he criticized the siege on the camp. And so whilst it's true that they are using similar tactics to Israeli soldiers, it's also, I think, very unsurprising that many are using the word shabiha to describe the security forces. Shabiha is a term that's commonly used for forces and groups that were loyal to Syria's former dictator, Bashar al-Assad. So on the one hand, yeah, they are similar tactics used by the Israeli regime, but there are also similar tactics that are used by other oppressive and authoritarian governments in the region. And I think for the PA, what is particularly astounding is that they've managed to have this very robust security sector without actually having a state. And that's because the focus of the so-called Palestinian state building project in the West Bank has always been about, you know, bolstering up this security sector. And it's funded by the likes of the US, the UK, the EU, all of whom provide these resources, weapons and training for the security forces. So it's not surprising that there are shared tactics across the board.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back and just kind of zoom in on this point that you made and the similarities of the terminology that's being used by Palestinians when referring to the Palestinian security forces, right? Using that term that was used by Syrians to criticize, the henchmen of Bashar al-Assad. I mean, that to me is very striking. And I don't know, I'm curious, has there been a moment like this where that sort of language and those comparisons have been drawn? Because that's indicative of just the anger and frustration that ordinary Palestinians are feeling watching this unfold. So has there been another moment like this where these sort of frustrations are coming to such a head? Or is this moment of betrayal that Palestinians are witnessing from their own forces, is that kind of unique to right now?
I think the use of the term shabiha in this current moment is topical, obviously, because of the fall of the Assad regime. So it's not surprising that people would use that language, but it's certainly not the first time that Palestinians have used that term to refer to the PA thugs, the PA security forces. And it's certainly not the first time that Palestinians have faced repression from the Palestinian security forces. I think this time is particularly egregious because it is reaching new levels of cruelty and violence. And I think also because it's happening simultaneously as the genocide in Gaza rages on. So there are moments that there are reasons why this moment is perhaps unique and is causing so much outrage. But there have been plenty of moments in recent Palestinian history where we have seen the really nasty and ugly side of the Palestinian security forces. You know, if we just go back to 2021, the Unity Intifada and how brutally that was put down by the Palestinian security forces when they killed the civil society activist Nazar Banat, and the demonstrations that followed his assassination were really horrifically put down in the streets of Ramallah and Bethlehem and other places. So this is not a new thing. PA cruelty, PA oppression is not new, and neither is trying to control the political landscape to make sure that they are the only ones who hold any kind of power. That is why the PA was established, to centralize that power into one governing body. So it's not new in that sense. But I think what's been shocking, at least for me, has been all these videos going round of the cruelty of the torture and the interrogations. And it's something that hurts even more, perhaps, than the cruelty of the Israeli regime, because this is coming from your own people, the people who are claiming to serve you and claiming to protect you.
Yeah, I've seen some of those reactions on social media, and it's exactly as you said. It's very painful for people, for Palestinians, to watch the Palestinian Authority besiege the refugee camp, cut off water and electricity, even invade the local hospitals in Jenin. Just these striking images that, like you said, you know, if it weren't for their uniforms, you would think it was the Israeli military carrying out these attacks. And I think what's especially painful right now for people, as you said as well, is that this is happening in the context of the genocide in Gaza. And, what we're speaking about now, what's happening in Jenin and the West Bank, and as you've alluded to throughout our conversation, those two things can't be separated. In an op-ed that you wrote recently for Al Jazeera, you said that for the PA leadership, the operation in Jenin is part of a much larger picture, one that allows it to position itself as the body to take over Gaza after a ceasefire. You also said that this is part of a larger, quote, crisis of legitimacy for the PA. So as we speak right now on January 14th, there are reports swirling of an imminent ceasefire. I want to ask you, you know, tell us more about, you know, what you mean by this crisis of legitimacy that the PA is in, and presumably that it's vying for a position of power in a post-war governance situation in Gaza.
So the crisis of legitimacy, I think, referred to the fact that public perceptions of the PA have plummeted even further since the start of the genocide, if that's possible. This is a deeply unpopular governing body, an unelected governing body, might I add. And I think, you know, the inability of this leadership to do anything at the time of genocide, to even say anything, has been enraging for so many people. And, you know, even worse yet, when people in the West Bank have mobilized against a genocide in Gaza, they have been brutally repressed by PA security forces. So its public perception really is in the mud. And I think, you know, the siege on Jenin refugee camp, even though not unexpected, has made that even worse. And the problem is that there isn't really an opposition, so to speak. There's no sort of possible alternative to the PA emerging. And that's also by design. And so I think whilst there is that popular sentiment that is anti-PA, it's also really difficult to think of an alternative. And the PA knows all of this, and they, you know, they're really trying to do damage control, or, you know, to shape the narrative. And one of the ways they've been doing that is limiting the reporting of its operations on journalists. And we've seen journalists being arrested and beaten up. But perhaps in an even bigger move, in a more shocking move, the PA actually suspended the Al Jazeera News Network from reporting in the West Bank. And in addition to suspending their operations, they've also ordered all of the telecommunication companies and channels to not broadcast anything from Jazeera. So even access to their websites have been blocked in the West Bank. And the justification for this is that Al Jazeera have been supposedly putting out inciting materials and reports that are stirring strife in its coverage of the siege of the camp. And this is a big deal. Al Jazeera is a foreign news network, so it can't be subjected to the same form of intimidation as local news networks. And so it can report more critically on the PA, and it has been doing so. And Al Jazeera's audience has been growing in Palestine, particularly because of its extensive coverage of the ongoing genocide in Gaza. And so it has been gaining more legitimacy and more popularity as this reliable source of information. And so for the PA to suspend it means that it's really concerned about its plummeting image. And I think it's particularly an egregious move at a time, you know, when Palestinian journalists, including those working for Al Jazeera, but also journalists across the board, are being targeted and killed at an exceptional rate by the Israeli regime forces. So all of this is to say that they're very concerned with their image, but instead of actually doing better and actually becoming an authority or some kind of governing body that the people could at least look to at this time of genocide, they've actually just been bolstering the Israeli regime's goals. And I think we have to understand all of this in the wider context of what the PA is and what it wants in the future. The PA is a governing body that was created by an outside force, and it's one that is supported and propped up by outside forces. It's not a body that is interested in Palestinian representation or legitimacy from the population. And I think as we're recording this, as you mentioned, it seems like a ceasefire deal is imminent. And I think, you know, the PA, everything that the PA has been doing in Jenin is to position itself in that post-ceasefire world.
I want to ask, I mean, you just ended on this point, right? That what the PA is doing in Jenin is trying to position itself in that sort of post-war world. I think this is a question that a lot of people have. So let's answer the question of what is the PA kind of seeking in Gaza? It's seeking some sort of role in governance, more functions of power. Still, how does fighting a resistance group in Jenin, in the West Bank, achieve some PA goals or visions of power in Gaza?
So I think for some in the PA leadership, they think, well, this is the equation, that, you know, if they prove themselves in Jenin, in the northern West Bank, in the camps, they pave the way for a takeover in Gaza. Because if they can prove that they can subdue these smaller armed resistance groups in the West Bank, then they prove that they won't allow for a Hamas return to power in Gaza. So I think, you know, they're trying to put on a show for the big boys, but I don't think the Israelis care about that. I think they're just happy for someone else to be doing their dirty work. But it is what the Biden administration has been vocalizing since, you know, the start of the genocide, that it would be the PA who would run Gaza if they can prove themselves. And the Biden administration has been really sort of keen on this idea. And we know that the Israelis haven't been. And sort of all signs from then, the Netanyahu government have been, you know, adamant that this is not going to happen. There are some within the Israeli government that have been a bit more cryptic and said that in its current form, the PA wouldn't take over Gaza. It's sort of in a similar vein, there have been other actors such as the UAE who've called for a reformed PA to govern. This word reform means new leadership, inevitably. So the PA, I think, is at one of its weakest points it has ever been. And so this is sort of one of its final efforts to cling on and to even cling on to power, but also to try and claim some more power. And it's really sad that this is what they have decided to do amidst the genocide.
And it's a very vivid picture that you paint of all the actors involved, all the different, all the pieces that are at play here, right? We talked about an imminent ceasefire deal, the PA vying for power, also for survival, for relevancy. But as we speak now as well, we're a little less than 1 week away from Trump coming back into office, which in the West Bank, at least, will very likely mean a return to explicitly pro-settlement and annexation policies. calls by Israeli settlers and far-right leaders for annexation of the West Bank have been getting louder. And some in just, you know, very recent weeks are calling for Israel to cut all ties with the PA. And this is as the PA has been conducting its operation in Jenin. And what you said was, you know, could be it's to try and prove itself to the big boys. But let's say for argument's sake, let's say the PA is successful in this operation. It manages to significantly weaken or even neutralize the resistance in Jenin, which, as you said earlier, is unlikely given that Israel itself has not managed to do that in Jenin and in the West Bank. But let's say the PA is quote unquote successful. Would it even matter to Israel and the US? Not just in, you know, a post-war Gaza, but in the West Bank, the territory that the PA currently has some sort of nominal control over, let's say. Would it even matter, or is the PA just fighting a losing game here?
I think that's a difficult question to answer. I'm not sure that it would matter, because I think what we've seen over the last 14 months is that what the Israelis and the Americans want will happen. Having said that, I also think it's difficult to predict what we can expect from a Trump administration. We know that Trump has been the one pushing hard for this latest ceasefire deal and putting pressure on Netanyahu, something which he said that he would do throughout his campaign, and many people didn't believe him. So that's transpiring to be the case. You know, what we can be certain about is that the situation for Palestinians is not going to get better. It's going to get worse across the board. I think it's also really important to remember that the Biden administration, and I think Mondo Vice published a piece about this, that, you know, has done more damage to the international norms of humanitarian law than any other U.S. government in recent history. So it's really difficult to say what's going to come and what's going to be worse, to make these comparisons between the Biden administration and the Trump administration. We know what we're getting with the Americans, and I think it's just how it's going to be presented. But we're living in unprecedented times. We did not expect that a genocide would be able to be conducted in this day and age with such cruelty and with such lack of accountability and such impunity. So I think, you know, I think it will be interesting to see. But I think really the PA is not a significant player for either the Israelis or the Americans. I think they're a useful tool, but I think they can be done away with or summoned at the behest of the Americans and the Israelis. It just depends where they fit into that wider picture.
I think we can leave it here. Dr. Yara Hawari of Al Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Rethinking Palestine is brought to you by Al Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. Al Shabaka is the only global independent Palestinian think tank whose mission is to produce critical policy analysis and collectively imagine a new policymaking paradigm for Palestine and Palestinians worldwide.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
While a ceasefire is largely holding in Gaza, Israel is intensifying attacks on the occupied West Bank. The Israeli military has killed at least 13 people in a major military operation targeting Jenin that began on Tuesday when Israeli troops raided the city backed by airstrikes, drones and Apache helicopters. Meanwhile, Israeli settler groups have carried out a new wave of attacks against Palestinians. On his first day in office, Trump rescinded sanctions imposed by President Biden on far-right Israeli settler groups. This is Jalal Bashir, head of the village council of Jina Safut.
Yesterday, we heard Trump's statement that he would reverse sanctions against settlers that assault Palestinians, along with Israeli Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir's release of arrested settlers. This all encourages violence and gives momentum to these attacks on our village.
Joining us now is Mariam Barghouti, Palestinian writer and journalist based in Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. Her new piece for Drop Site News headlined Israel invades Jenin days after signing Gaza ceasefire. Talk about that, Mariam. This connection between the ceasefire in Gaza and the intensified attacks on the West Bank and the number of people who've been killed, the role, and particularly if you can talk about doctors and hospitals being targeted.
All right. Thank you, Amy. So what we're seeing right now is an operation dubbed Operation Iron Wall, waged by the Israeli government against the West Bank, specifically targeting Jenin and Jenin refugee camp that is north of the West Bank. And what we have seen in the last 72 hours is 13 Palestinians at least have been killed. Of them is a 16-year-old boy. Now, while the Israeli military spokesperson claims that they have targeted and eliminated 13 terrorists, it is important to recollect and realize that most were civilians that were killed, including a young 16-year-old boy, including a father who was killed in front of his son. And we're seeing reports of field executions. But in fact, we actually don't know the real number of those killed or injured because the Israeli military is denying access to medical personnel inside the camp. So we're seeing Israel wage a war that very much resembles the practices they have committed in Gaza. According to colleagues on the ground, they're comparing it to what Israel did in Jabalia, north of Gaza, including the field executions, including the displacement of families at gunpoint, forcing them to escape their homes and creating a corridor, a humanitarian corridor from the camp to the outside of the camp for families to leave, giving them until the end of today or else. And this is what the soldiers would tell families, leave or else.
Mariam, could you talk about the impact of the fact that on his first day in office, President Trump lifted Biden-era sanctions against Israeli settlers accused of violence against Palestinians. It was on that day itself that Israeli settlers stormed several villages in the occupied West Bank. If you could respond to that decision by Trump and what impact it's had on the ground.
Of course, what we're seeing with Trump's swearing in the day after is an emboldened Israeli regime. And let's remember that in his last term, President Trump had declared Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, which further pushed settlers to basically rampage through Jerusalem and the West Bank at unprecedented levels of violence against Palestinians. So what we're seeing from the Palestinian end in regards to Trump's inauguration again is a fear that settlers are going to even feel more emboldened, especially in light of the impunity that Israel has, despite the genocide it has committed in Gaza. Because as of now, we haven't seen any real accountability measures against war criminals, Israeli war criminals. So Palestinians are frightened, while on the other hand, we're seeing settlers celebrate President Trump. In fact, in the E1 area near Jerusalem, settlers are calling for the renaming of some settlement blocks in honor of Trump as Trump blocks. So we're seeing the discrepancy here and disparity and the likely violence that may erupt in the coming weeks and months.
I wanted to ask the effect of the Trump presidency right now and how it is affecting what's going on there. You have the choice to become the next U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, former Congress member Lee Stefanik, refusing to say Tuesday whether the Palestinian people have a right to self-determination. She made her comments while she was being questioned by the Senate Foreign Relations, Maryland Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen, who said, she said that Israel has a biblical right to dominion over the occupied West Bank. So we're talking about annexation of the West Bank. What does that mean, Mariam, for the people of the West Bank?
It means more displacement. It means pushing Palestinian families out of their lands. And we're seeing this increase. The level of outposts being erected in the last 15 months has been unprecedented. And at the same time, primarily the American government, in support, with support from Europe as well and Canada, they have left the Palestinians completely defenseless. Palestinians are not allowed to have an army. Palestinians are not allowed to confront Israeli soldiers that are invading their homes. Now, we must remember that the Israeli military is carrying out an offensive on Jenin, which is in the West Bank, which Israeli presence is deemed illegal under international law, and the UN has voted as Israel being illegally present in the West Bank and Gaza. So what that means is more violence, but also it's sinister in that the continued arming of Israel with D9 bulldozers, with Blue 109 bombs, and then the stripping of Palestinians, not just of the right to self-determination, but any capacity to survive. Things like not condemning the cutting off of water from families or electricity or denying them medical capacity and access. It's a very slow slaughter of Palestinians. So if you survive a bullet, you don't know if you're going to survive daily life.
And Mariam, could you also talk about, you've written about this, the fact that this Operation Iron Wall coincides with the longest and most lethal campaign by the Palestinian Authority also on Jenin.
Yes. Yes. So what we're seeing in this operation, which the Israeli military spokes released a statement today saying it is the most advanced operation of its kind in the region and in the area. What we are seeing is direct coordination and collaboration with the Palestinian Authority, which has arrested journalists in the past few days who have covered Jenin, and they have arrested resistance fighters, and we have heard reports of them facing torture at the hands of the Palestinian Authority. Now, it's really important to recognize that Operation Iron Wall comes just a day after the Palestinian Authority allegedly ended its six-week-long siege on Jenin refugee camp, where they cut electricity from families, where they denied them access to medical care and even targeted medics in a similar fashion to Israel. So what we're really seeing is a proxy army for Israel and the Israeli army really targeting Palestinians in the West Bank right now who have no one protecting them, essentially, other than the small groups of resistance fighters who are realistically no match to the power and technology that Israel has and the coordination with the Palestinian Authority.
Mariam Barghouti, do you think Israel is using the siege on Jenin to indirectly break the ceasefire deal in Gaza?
No. What we also need to remember is that even before October 7th, Israeli officials and politicians, as well as military commanders, were calling for a large-scale invasion of the West Bank. This has been a procedure that has been placed in effect long before October 7th. It has also, we do know that this operation was planned in tandem with the ceasefire negotiations, so we know it is pre-planned. But it's also important to recognize that the ultimate goal of Israeli colonial practice is to push Palestinians out. So it doesn't necessarily have to be an obstruction to the ceasefire, but it does act and align with Israel's overall goal.
Mariam Barghouti, we want to thank you for being with us. Palestinian writer and journalist based in Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. We'll link to your new article at Drop Site News. Israel invades Jenin days after signing Gaza ceasefire. Tens of thousands of displaced Palestinians are returning home to the north of Gaza for the first time since they were forced to flee their homes at the start of Israel's war on Gaza over a year ago. A river of people that stretch for miles walked north along Gaza's coastal road Monday, carrying what's left of their possessions. Most Palestinians will be returning to find their homes reduced to rubble. The UN estimates 92% of homes in Gaza have been destroyed or damaged over the last 16 months. President Trump's facing accusations of supporting ethnic cleansing in Gaza after saying he wants to, quote, clean out the whole thing. Trump called for Egypt and Jordan to take in Palestinians living in Gaza while speaking to reporters aboard Air Force One Saturday. He told the reporters he'd spoken to King Abdullah of Jordan.
I said to him, I'd love you to take on more, because I'm looking at the whole Gaza Strip right now, and it's a mess. It's a real mess.
So you'd like Jordan to house people from Gaza?
To take people. I'd like Egypt to take people. I'm meeting with, I'm talking to General al-Sisi tomorrow, sometime, I believe. And I'd like Egypt to take people, and I'd like Jordan to take people. I mean, you're talking about probably 1.5 million people. And we
just clean out that whole thing. It's over the centuries, that's had many, many conflicts, that site. And I don't know, something has to happen, but it's literally a demolition site right now. Almost everything's demolished.
Egypt and Jordan have both rejected Trump's suggestion and emphasized a two-state solution ensuring Palestinian statehood is the only way forward. Hamas and displaced Palestinians in Gaza also rejected the idea of being forced out of Gaza. This is Magdi Saddam, a Palestinian waiting to return to northern Gaza.
The call by the U.S. president is completely rejected. Completely. Completely. If he thinks he will forcibly displace the Palestinian people, this is impossible. Impossible. The Palestinian people firmly believe that this land is theirs. This soil is their soil. No matter how much Israel tries to destroy, break, and to show people that it had won, in reality, it did not win. It destroyed and ruined things and showed the people that it is a failed state.
Trump's suggestion that more than a million Palestinians should be moved out of Gaza to neighboring Arab states weren't his first controversial comments on Gaza since returning to office. Shortly after his inauguration last week, Trump said he's, quote, not confident the ceasefire will remain in place. He said Gaza appeared to be a, quote, massive demolition site that should be rebuilt.
You know, Gaza's interesting. It's a phenomenal location on the sea. The best weather, you know, everything's good. It's like some beautiful things could be done with it, but it's very interesting. But some fantastic things could be done with Gaza.
For more on reactions to President Trump's calls to, quote, clean out Gaza, we're joined by the Emmy and Polk Award-winning Egyptian-American journalist Sharifa Gokhadoos. He works with Drop Site News and spent years reporting from Egypt as well as from Gaza and the West Bank. He was correspondent on Al Jazeera's Fault Lines documentary, The Night Won't End, Biden's War on Gaza, and did a Polk Award-winning documentary on the killing of the Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akla. Sharif, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you here. So these comments of Trump, the last ones echo his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who had said in the last year that Gaza is great beachfront property, talking about it as a kind of real estate deal. Trump, most recently on Air Force One on Saturday night, saying that the more than a million Palestinians should be moved to Egypt and Jordan, that he spoke to the Jordanian king. Meanwhile, Jordan and Egypt talk about their responses, and most importantly, the response of Palestinians.
Well, both Jordan and Egypt have rejected this, and they've done so since the beginning of this genocidal assault. These comments were welcomed by the far-right ministers Smotrich and Ben-Gavir, who said, this would be the voluntary emigration that they've been dreaming about for Palestinians to be forcibly displaced outside of Gaza and for them to rebuild Jewish settlements in Gaza. I think we have to acknowledge what's happening today, which are these incredible scenes of tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of Palestinians who have withstood an unprecedented genocidal assault, returning back to the north. We spoke at Drop Site to Mustafa Barghouti just a few days ago, and he said the return of forcibly displaced Palestinians to the north will be the ultimate defeat of Israeli plans, because it means that the goal of ethnic cleansing did not materialize. Let's remember what happened if we go back to October 7th, 2023, when Benjamin Netanyahu took to the airwaves and declared war on Gaza. He said, leave now, to the 2.3 million Palestinians who are living in Gaza. Just a few days later, we saw this shocking directive for all 1.1 million Palestinians who are north of Wadi Gaza to flee to the south. And we saw this unbelievable, unprecedented aerial bombing campaign, and many people forcibly displaced to the south, many of them to Rafah in the beginning. And let's not forget that at the time, Western governments, including the United States government under the Biden administration, were trying to persuade Egypt to take in hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, displace them in northern Sinai, offering economic incentives. There's reporting that shows that this was taking place. Egypt rejected it at the time, but more importantly, Palestinians rejected this. And then we saw them build what's called the Netzarim Corridor, which bisected Gaza. This was a 6 or 7 kilometer wide strip of land. They completely depopulated, forcibly displaced, ethnically cleansed that area, destroyed almost all of the buildings there, set up military bases. And this was essentially, reporting shows in Haaretz, this was called a kill zone. Any man, woman, or child unarmed would enter. It's unclear where the border was of the Netzarim corridor. They would be shot and killed. And this was essentially the place that divided Gaza. Once you crossed there, you could not go back. We saw in October also a concentrated extermination campaign in the very north of Gaza, in Jabalia, Jabalia refugee camp, in Beit Hanun and Beit Lahia, where they completely did not allow any aid in, and then very systematically started attacking these towns and cities and forcing people out on essentially what were death marches to the south across the Netzarim corridor and back. And, you know, despite all of this, people withstood, they remained on their land, and now we're seeing these incredible scenes of people returning home. And to think that, you know, Trump can just say they should move to Egypt or Jordan, I think, you know, is preposterous. And we're seeing right now that this is kind of an ultimate defeat of the plans of ethnic cleansing that have dated back to the 1950s for Israel.
So I wanted to go to that quote of Jared Kushner made months ago. That's Trump's son-in-law and former advisor weighing in on Israel's war on Gaza, saying Israel should move Palestinians out of the besieged territory, which he said contains very valuable waterfront property, making the remarks during an event hosted by the Middle East Initiative at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.
In Gaza's waterfront property, it could be very valuable to if people would focus on kind of building up, you know, livelihoods. You think about all the money that's gone into this tunnel network and into all the munitions. If that would have gone into education or innovation, what could have been done? And so I think that it's a little bit of an unfortunate situation there. But I think from Israel's perspective, I would do my best to move the people out and then clean it up. But I don't think that Israel has stated that they don't want the people to move back there afterwards.
So that's pretty amazing comment. Invaluable beachfront property. Earlier today, I was watching the Palestinian attorney Diana Bhutu on Al Jazeera when asked about what Trump said. You know, I think all agree it does look like a demolition zone. There's no question about it. How can Palestinians live there? And she said, okay, if there's that question, rather than moving them to neighboring Arab states like Egypt and Jordan, what about moving them home? She said 80% of the people of Gaza come from places in Israel.
Yeah, I mean, this is why Gaza has long been a site of resistance in historic Palestine and long been a place that Israel wants to ethnically cleanse, because it is the largest concentration of Palestinian refugees in historic Palestine. So there's always been a rest of place. These people who, 80% of them or their descendants, want to return to their homes, which are mostly the towns and villages around Gaza. And like you said, this is now, they are returning in these really incredible scenes that we're seeing right now.
I mean, but this is a flood of humanity.
People hugging who haven't seen, they've been separated from their family members, from mothers and fathers, separated from their children for 15 months, and they're reuniting for the first time. They never thought they would see each other again. But they are returning to, as you said, a devastated landscape. Nearly the entire, every house has been destroyed or badly damaged. People, the government authorities are telling people to bring their tents with them. There are not even enough tents for people to set up on the rubble of their homes. And as we've been seeing in other parts as well, while Israel has violated the ceasefire nearly every single day, killing Palestinians, especially in Rafah, the death count, the official death count, has been also shooting up since the 19th, when the ceasefire went into effect, because dozens of bodies are being recovered from under the rubble. And so, you know, I'm afraid we're going to see a lot of this as people search for their loved ones as they're returning to this devastated landscape. But they're determined not to leave their land, and many of them will set up tents on the rubble of their homes.
And then we go to the West Bank and what's happening there. We just spoke to Mariam Barghouti. You wrote a piece with her for Dropsite. If you can talk about the intensification of violence against Palestinians there.
Well, essentially what we saw soon after the ceasefire went into effect, a war on the West Bank, initially dubbed the Iron Wall. All of these things had been taking place already, attacks on Jenin, closures of checkpoints and so forth, but a massive escalation of this, to the likes of which we haven't seen since 2002, an invasion of Jenin. Right now, they are demolishing the refugee camp, not just with bulldozers as we've seen in the past, they are actually detonating, the way they have done in Gaza, parts of this. 2,000 families have already been displaced. Across the West Bank, there was usually around 700 military checkpoints. Now there's close to 1,000. They've all closed down. Cities have been closed off from each other. People can't leave their towns and villages to go to school, to go to work. They're separated from each other. And so this is, they're laying siege to the West Bank. And a lot of what we show in the reporting and what has been said was that this was a trade-off that Netanyahu, trying to convince his ministers like Smotrich and Ben-Gavir to sign on to the Gaza ceasefire plan, that they would launch this kind of unprecedented military assault on the West Bank.